And the first day of our 7-day retreat. And it helps to know that a 7-day retreat is a journey that is not going to be the first day for 7 days. It's not uncommon, as I've been saying, for the first day to be in some way or other challenging for people. The common phenomena is that people come to retreat tired, and so the first day people are tired and they try to meditate and they fall asleep. Or their lives are so busy that there's all this unacknowledged, unexamined or backlog of things that kind of ready to come forward. Thoughts, concerns, feelings, and so they come spilling forward. You thought you would sit down and get focused and concentrated and sit peacefully ever after. And it turned out your mind had other ideas. But it's nice to think of this as a journey of discovery. And as a journey, it takes a while. It takes a while. Sometimes the initial part is challenging, like going backpacking. And the first time I went backpacking alone, I didn't know where I was going. And I went to the Big Sur coast into Big Sur, Pfeiffer State Park. And the first hike in was 12 miles uphill, more or less. And that was my beginning. And I made it to the top, and then it became pretty easy, pretty wonderful to be back there. So the first, often the beginning, you know, it takes a while to settle in, get adjusted to it. But it's a journey, and the journey keeps unfolding. And I think of it as a journey of discovery, and it's a discovery of ourselves, discovery of being here in a different way than it's often possible in ordinary life, where maybe you're busy or preoccupied, caught up, or where there isn't the opportunity to sit quietly and really be present, to find out who you are, what's going on in some deep way. And it's not just a matter of discovering who you are in some biographical way or finding out who, you know, your different kinds of impulses and thoughts and things like that, but finding out what it's like to be a human being, what it's like to be alive, and how is it that we approach being alive here in this world. And as a process of discovery, a journey of discovery, meditation, mindfulness, Buddhism has a lot to do about discovering here, arriving here. So it's a little bit different than a journey, a conventional journey where you start at A and you end up in B. Here we start in A and we end up in A. But we end up in A in a much more, very different way than we were at the beginning. We understand ourselves much better, we understand our life much better. We wake up to what's happening here. We wake up to the lived experience of our life in a high-quality way, in a way that in Buddhism we call is free or liberated, a way of being present where some of the most beautiful capacities of the mind and heart have a chance to shine forth. So in the Buddhist tradition we say that that includes things like wisdom, a sense of freedom, being awake, and also compassion and love. That these are the things that somehow we discover are here. It isn't that they're so much that we're going to manufacture them, but more, it's, I think, much more about relaxing or opening up and discovering this capacity we have here. So I think we can recognize that we all have many capacities. We have many potentials, many forces that operate within us. And we could operate under forces that involved greed, hate, and delusion. We could operate under forces that have to do with mostly propelled by doubt, propelled by sometimes lethargy, laziness, resistance, propelled by mindlessness, being agitated and not really kind of paying attention to your life as it's being lived. You can be, we have the capacity to live fragmented from ourselves, cut off from ourselves, spinning around a lot, running in circles. And we have the capacity to be stupid, We have the capacity to be foolish or be deluded. But just as we have those capacities, we also have the capacities to be tremendous confidence, faith, inspiration. We have capacities for to be strong, have strength, variety of different types. We have capacities to be mindful, to have a kind of a heightened awareness and sensitivity to the life that we're living. We have a capacity to have the mind to be stable, steady, to be grounded, to be centered in the middle of our life and not jumping around. And we have the capacity for wisdom. And these five are capacities are what the theme of this retreat is, which is the five faculties. So usually in English it's translated as faith, and then there's strength or energy, and then there's mindfulness, and then there's concentration, and then there's wisdom. And the word for these faculties in the ancient Indian language is Indriya. And Indriya comes from the word for the god Indra. In the ancient world, there was kind of like maybe Zeus or something. In Greece, there was this god who was kind of the big sovereign god of the Indian pantheon, and that god was called Indra. So Indriya is like Indriya, like Indra. And so, and how it's like it is those capacities, faculties we have that can have some kind of capacity to support us, to guide us, to give us strength, to control what's going on. Just as much, or even, you know, so if you're angry, that can control you. If you're greedy and filled with lust, that can kind of take over sometimes. So there's different forces that can take over. And it isn't that we want the indriyas, the five faculties, to take over, but they provide us the strength and the capacity so that we can live a wiser life, a better life. And one of the definitions of a wiser life, especially that's relevant for the retreat, is to live a life which is connected, connected to the present, connected to what I like to call the lived experience. It's pretty precious that we are alive. And you know, some of you know the story I like to tell, that for a while I was fond of looking at old photographs. The older the better. And it took me a while to realize why I like looking at them. But I would kind of be gravitated if there was people's walls or something, there was an old photograph. I mean, old enough so that people in the photograph, there had to be people in the photograph. Old enough so that people weren't clearly not alive. And I'd go over and look closely. And the thing I would look at most carefully was their eyes. And then I would look at their expression in their face. And there were, I remember seeing some in a restaurant up here in the mountains here, old photograph of loggers from the 1800s, I think. And I would look very carefully at them. And you see the expression of the moment, the emotion of the moment. And sometimes you look at their faces, and it wasn't just the emotion of the moment, but you got a sense, I got a sense that this is the emotion of a lifetime. You know, that this is, they were kind of holding something or carrying something. But then I'd look at their eyes, and occasionally it seemed like some of those old photographs, the quality was quite high. And I would see this little sparkle in their eyes. And that sparkle was their kind of their spark of, I saw it as the spark of their consciousness. And what I would realize looking at it, this was their moment to be alive. And they had their moment, they had their time, that was their time. And why this is so meaningful for me was it was a reminder, and this is my time. This is my time. How much more time do I have? I mean, you know, one moment of consciousness. Consciousness is an amazing thing, to be aware, to be present, to be conscious of life. What an amazing accomplishment. Whoever came up with human beings that are conscious, whether it was a god or whether it was evolution or whether it was, who knows how it got here, but it's a kind of a remarkable thing that we have for these few years, this ability to be present. And then how much time are you really present? How much time are you actually aware that you're living in the conscious present moment? I know that I have a capacity to spend time thinking about the future and planning planning all kinds of futures, or worrying about the future, or get lost in the past and thinking about the past, or being in fantasy. And I find for myself that I'm involved in fantasy, thinking about the future, the past, having conversations with imaginary or real people, real in the sense that, you know, people I know who are not present. I lose touch with the lived present right now. And there's a qualitative difference in my life between being involved in these thoughts and lost in them and having this heightened capacity to be present here. And so part of this journey, part of the function of the five faculties, is to help us find value and meaning and support for being present here. Now, being present and awake, being conscious here and now, in Buddhism, is not so that we can suffer better if we're suffering. You know, some of us have, there's lots of suffering, lots of challenges people have. And one of the reasons people check out, people don't pay attention, they distract themselves, watch TV or whatever, is because it's uncomfortable to be present for life as it's lived. But the journey that we're on is a journey to enter into life as it's lived, to be really present here for ourselves and what's going on in a heightened, kind of a stronger way than usual. And then to begin to work through some of that suffering, work through some of the impulses and movements that we have that lead to that suffering here and now, that support it, that perpetuate it. We can work through and find a way to be here, be alive, be here at A, be present, in a way that the heart is at peace, rest with itself. The heart, the mind is not in conflict. And it's one of the really beautiful things to do, because you know, I think there's nothing better to do in the world than to discover a heart, to have a heart that is at peace, that's filled with compassion and love and care, and is not caught in the grip of greed and desire and hate and vengeance and the kind of things that is also common in our world. And it's one thing to do it for oneself, and then to know that it's possible for yourself to some degree, and then to support other people to do that, to realize that this is a capacity for all of us to have this. It's certainly a lot better, that as a goal in life, than a lot of other goals people could have. Last week there was a frenzy of people in America interested in, what was it called, the super lottery? Powerball or something, is that what it's called? I'm not quite sure, but I could see there was this big number next to the lottery. And they say that they've done studies of people who have won the lottery, and the huge lotteries, and a year later they feel their life is less happy than before they won the lottery. So you can imagine, maybe you can kind of imagine why, what happens. So there's a lot of pursuit of status, wealth, bigger homes, bigger jobs, recognition, having everyone in the world like you is a big thing that a lot of people, I was neurotically concerned with that for a long time. Gave me a big headache. So there's a lot of concerns of pursuits that people have that are not so healthy for people to have. There are beautiful pursuits people have that are wonderful to do, but they're much better done if we know if the heart has been settled, if the heart is at peace, if the heart has discovered a capacity for open-hearted generosity and love. So we enter into this present moment to discover this journey into it. And the first day of a retreat, it's hard to do for some of you, I imagine. The mind doesn't want to be quiet. It wants to be anywhere but here. I've been in situations where I couldn't wait to be on retreat. And it was so important for me, like the most important thing I had in mind for my life. And it was with so much purpose and meaning that I came, and I knew it was going to be great. And then by the second day, I was wishing I was somewhere else. Strange mind, isn't it? The mind doesn't seem to. So So then the mind gets caught up in that, or the body aches or it hurts, and so we're caught up in things like that. But to rather than seeing these as problems, the opportunity here is to really be curious and interested and discover, what is this? What's going on? And more importantly, what are the strategies you have in reacting to it? When you're challenged, what do you do? Do you go to sleep, go down and take a nap when you don't need to? Do you eat, you go down to the snack and get snacks? Do you go into fantasy? Do you get angry? Do you blame someone? Maybe yourself? Do you start having desire thoughts? Do you get discouraged? What happens to you when you're challenged? What happens when you start looking at yourself more deeply? And one of the things that opportunity for retreats like this is, because we're sitting in silence for some long period of time, just looking and being present, looking and being present, that we get to see ourselves without interruption, or without as much interruption as we have in our daily life. And so we get to see how the common patterns of how our mind works much more acutely. And we see there are patterns. We keep responding the same way. Every time there's something that's challenging for us, we get angry at ourselves. You know, I'm doing it wrong. Or we get angry at everyone else. They're doing it wrong. Aversive minds tend to find something that's wrong. Or there could be something is wrong, and so we get caught up in desires, fantasies. Right? So much desire for this retreat, and now this retreat is not going so well, or even is going well. Let's plan the next retreat. I've sat on retreats where it was going very well. I felt very calm and centered and concentrated, and felt really good. That this is good. I'm here. And then I'll spend the next hour or two or three planning the next retreat, so I can really be present. You know, it's kind of silly, right? Because I am present. I was present until I started planning how to be present again. So it was a strategy. My mind, you know, I have sometimes a planning mind, so I got caught up. That was my strategy. I got caught up, and it was kind of ridiculous, right? So we get to see how it works. And that's the, you know, part of the opportunity of being in retreat is begin to seeing how we work. What goes on? And to have more interest in discovering what's going on than you are interested in perpetuating your normal patterns of behavior. So to have interest be more, or to say it differently, to give more authority to your curiosity than to your desire, aversion, fantasies, planning mind, remembering mind that you have. We give tremendous authority. We give ourselves over to so many of these inner forces over and over again. And don't give yourself over to it, but rather give yourself over to something like curiosity or interest or being awake or being mindful, so you can discover what it is rather than succumbing to what it is. So the five faculties begin with a word in Pali called, in ancient Buddhist language, called sadda, S-A-D-D-H-A. And it's usually translated into English as faith. And some other translators translate it as confidence and conviction. I sometimes like the word trust. My favorite word is confidence for it. But faith is nice too. And one of the reasons I like faith is that faith, for me, has a kind of heartfelt quality to it. It's where we put our hearts, what we have faith in. Whereas even though I like the word confidence a lot, or trust a lot, sometimes in my mind, when my mind uses words, it doesn't have the same heartfelt quality as the word faith. Some people don't like the word faith because in some Western religions, faith has the idea of a tenet of belief that you have to believe in. And if you believe, only are you properly in the religion if you believe this faith, this tenet. And so it's rather discouraging in that context then to hear that it's good to have faith in Buddhism. But faith here in Buddhism is not a tenet of belief that you have to believe in. It has much more to do with having confidence in a possibility, a potential that you have, and a confidence in your ability to attain and achieve that. The word sada, or in Sanskrit shraddha, the earliest usage of the word in India, in the ancient Vedic text, it meant hospitality. And I like this. I don't know if by that time the Buddha came around whether it lost that meaning entirely, but it's kind of nice that it has its origins in the word hospitality, to be a good host to your experience. How to be a host to whatever's going on, a good host. So to have confidence is an interesting quality. We all have the capacity, we all have the faculty, the facility to have confidence. But confidence is not always there. And confidence is kind of an interesting thing because I don't think you can do confidence. You can have confidence. You can possess confidence. You can cultivate confidence. And confidence is there to support you, but you don't do confidence. If I tell you, just be confident, I don't think that's very helpful. It's more like a state or a capacity that can be strong or weak. So if you learn to ride a bike, at first, perhaps there's very little confidence. And part of why it's shaky and difficult is lack of confidence. You feel nervous and a little tense as we're doing it. But as we keep riding the bike, at some point we feel confident in our ability to ride the bike and not fall. At some point the confidence becomes so normal, we not even think about having confidence. It's just kind of second nature maybe to ride a bike, until we fall. And then you're a little bit shaky and the confidence is kind of missing a little bit. And so then maybe by continuing to ride the bike and bit by bit the confidence comes back, you feel more confident again. And so the confidence is there and the confidence supports us. So we cultivate the confidence riding the bike, perhaps by going back on the bike and maybe riding for a little bit or riding in safe places first, flat ground or something. And then we slowly kind of develop the confidence again. And so the confidence is there and the confidence is there that supports us. If you're going to go biking in a difficult terrain, then it might be useful sometimes to call upon your confidence and remind yourself that, yes, I can ride a bike, I know how to do it, and the sense of confidence supports you as you go to do it. So the same thing with practicing meditation. It's helpful to have confidence. And confidence, a lot of it is earned or learned by doing it. Just like riding the bike, you have to do it. You might initially have confidence in the person who's teaching you to ride a bike. Well, if this person tells me I can do it, maybe I can. And so you're willing to try it. But at some point, you have to develop the confidence by doing it. So with meditation, maybe you have confidence in the people who told you that it's a good idea. Maybe you have confidence in Andre and I, that you're here. But our job is mostly kind of like, to take off the training wheels and to help you learn how to ride the bike, how to learn how to be present and meditate on your own. And at some point you start developing confidence in your ability to do so. And you have confidence in your ability, confidence in the purpose and the value of doing it, and confidence in the possibility of where it can go, the meaning it has for you. And now this stands in contrast to other things that you might or other people might have confidence in. Some of you might have more confidence in your neurosis than you have in meditation or your ability to do meditation. More confidence in your anxieties. More confidence in your fantasies, because that's where the mind wants to go. I mean, not you, of course. You don't have that kind of issue, I know. But your mind has more confidence in these kinds of things. So the mind keeps going there. And generally the mind does things repeatedly because it believes there's some value in it, or because there's some authority or significance that it attributes to these kinds of things. And so, for example, if there's a lot of anxiety that's operating, probably there's something in the mind that believes that if, you know, is looking for safety and has some gives authority or meaning to the search for safety because that seems important. And so the mind keeps going there. In meditation, what helps a lot is to start shifting where we have confidence. No longer to shift our confidence from fear or self-identity or trying to build up a story about ourselves or confidence in repeating a conversation or event from long ago until we get figure it out. We shift our confidence away from planning and thinking about the future and shift and start replacing it with confidence of being present here. Confidence in the lived experience of here and now. The kind of confidence that helps us to connect to the present moment, to be more present, so we're not separate from the present moment. So I'll say more about that in a minute. In Buddhism, the ancient texts, time of the Buddha, they said the primary thing that people were encouraged to have confidence in or faith in was the enlightenment of the Buddha. His awakening, that there was a person who followed this path of meditation, followed the spiritual path, a person who said because he had the five faculties, he was inspired or felt confident to engage in search for liberation. And so the Buddha kind of engaged in this path, in this process, and discovered that it's possible to have a heart which is at peace. Find a heart mind which is not in conflict and not caught by fear and desire and anger, and in realizing that, we say he became awake or he became enlightened. So the classic idea of confidence is to have confidence in that potential, that possibility, because without some confidence in that, at least being able to go in that direction, maybe not get enlightened like the Buddha, but to move in that direction, then why would you try? Then other things might seem much more compelling, other voices, other sources of authority of things that seem important. And so to have confidence, yes, it is possible. I don't have to continue living exactly like I have caught up in and afraid and suffering. There is another way. Now, in having confidence like that, you know, there's a possibility, there's something to attain, liberation to attain, then the confidence could, in theory, could possibly take you away from the present moment rather than into it. Because it's possible to have the goal be out there in the future. If only if I huff and puff here, and if I really try hard and really kind of focus, then someplace in the future I will become free. And if you pay attention to to yourself carefully enough, you can kind of feel how certain kind of ideation, certain kind of thoughts and purpose and striving actually disconnect you from the lived moment of now. And certain kind of faith helps you, supports you to be present here and now. And so the task here, it's partly the wisdom factor that Andrea mentioned yesterday, is to be able to use that to see it, differentiate, is this being helpful for me, what I'm doing, or not? And for the purpose of meditation, is what I'm doing with my mind, with my behavior, what I'm doing here, is it in the support of being present, or does it separate me from the present? Does it create distance between the present and my awareness of it and presence of it? And if you see that difference, can make that distinction, then you have the chance, perhaps, to make a choice. What would you rather do? Would you rather continue being separate, or would you like to rather be on a path to being more present, to come here, be here, be here? So the first thing that the ancient tradition talked about was having confidence in the Buddha's awakening, faith, to be inspired by it. To be inspired. It's one of the most beautiful, it's probably, I think, the most beautiful thing that you'll ever experience in your life, more beautiful than looking out at the beautiful sunset on the ocean, more beautiful than going into the Yosemite and seeing the beautiful, beautiful mountains there, is a purified heart. a liberated heart, a pure heart is really something to see, to experience. And so to be inspired, to have faith in that possibility. And it's not an abstract faith like it's someone else, it's something that's possible for you. And then to have confidence in yourself is very important. And so how do you have confidence in yourself? Confidence in yourself to do this path, to engage in this, that you can, that's meaningful. I don't know how you're supposed to have confidence in yourself, short of trying it out. And trying out small steps. I think to have, sometimes people trip over the idea of confidence if they think they're supposed to have like just full-blown confidence from day one. But rather, if maybe maybe it's enough to have confidence that when you go out to do a walking meditation, it's a 45-minute period, you need to go to the bathroom and have tea, to have confidence that you can keep steady for that period of time and not leave your walking path, just walking back and forth for 30 minutes. That you go back and forth, and you might feel impulses to take a break, to do something else, to look around, to go pet the cat. No, you're gonna hold the course for those 30 minutes. And then doing that, then you develop confidence. Yeah, I can do it for those 30 minutes. Or you come to meditate in the hall, and a small step in developing confidence is, you know, it's really good to have your sights, have low sights at first. Is what it's called in English, to have your sights low. Be very modest in what you're trying to accomplish. So maybe first what you do is try to manage to do two breaths in a row, to be mindful of two breaths in a row. And when you manage to do that, maybe it takes a while, then you have confidence, well, I can at least try to do two breaths. Then you can do try to do three, and then four, and then five, and then 10. But to slowly build it. But if you sit down to meditate and say, I'm going to try to be present for my breath from here until the time they ring the bell, chances are for most of us that that's going to be discouraging because you're not going to manage. But do it in small chunks and slowly build on it. Build some confidence. And that's a way of slowly building the confidence. Oh, I can do two breaths, that's good. Rather than being discouraged, or two breaths is nothing, that's a strategy. That's, oh, look at that, I tend to be discouraged. Instead, can you turn it around for yourself in a way that supports you and say, two breaths is great. And slowly begin to feed yourself, nourish yourself with some confidence and develop it. And then the confidence is there to support you. And then it's helpful to have confidence in the practice you're doing. And so if you have practice instruction like mindfulness instruction or concentration instruction or whatever, walking instruction, is to have some confidence that that instruction is worthwhile to do. I know for me, when I learned walking meditation, I did not have much confidence in the walking meditation. But I had confidence in my teachers who told me to do it. So I relied on my confidence in them to do it, and then slowly by doing it, I began to learn the tremendous value of doing walking meditation. For sitting meditation, for me, I didn't have to rely on my teachers who told me it was a good idea, because relatively early on in my starting to meditate, I didn't get concentrated, I didn't feel like I was particularly mindful, but there was something about the connection or the presence or the sense of not being so constantly caught up in my distractions and neurosis that was very meaningful for me. Or when I was involved in fear and anxiety and guilt and all these different things that I was capable of doing back when I was young, there was something very meaningful to me about kind of being present for it, knowing it was going on. Because when I wasn't meditating, it would go on, and I would kind of know those things were going on, but I was really being oppressed by them. And there was something about sitting and being present in meditation that loosened it up a little bit, or made something a different reference point for how it all was. And that was very meaningful for me, that kept me going. at some point I started feeling a sense of integrity by meditating that really hooked me to meditation. And that was the idea that I had when I was starting, was the sense of integrity. There was a wholeness. I didn't have much capacity for concentration. I didn't have much capacity for mindfulness. But somehow, as I sat there and was present for what was, there was a kind of lack of resistance or lack of separation or lack of pushing things away that started to happen, that things started to feel whole or integral, a sense of integrity that was the words I expressed to myself. And the word integrity worked well for me because also it had a feeling of kind of ethical integrity as well, in that state. And so it wasn't so much that I had faith in my teachers for meditation, but rather I started to have faith or confidence in what was happening to me as I practiced. And so I just kept following that faith or that inspiration or that, I just took it to the next step and took it to the next step. So one of the interesting questions I think for you to ask yourself is, what do you have confidence in? What do you have faith in? Do you have confidence in your planning mind? Do you have confidence in your remembering mind, story-making mind? Do you have confidence in being afraid? Do you have confidence in being angry or being critical or being aversive? Do you have confidence in your capacity to be present? Do you have confidence in your curiosity and interest? Do you have confidence in the practice? Do you have confidence that it's valuable to be present, to be here? Because if you don't have confidence that it's valuable and meaningful to be here and be present, then it's going to be hard to really want to be here. Then it's other things are going to pull you away and seem more important. So to spend a little bit of time reflecting on what you have confidence in, and then consciously see if you can pull forth or touch into confidence that supports you to be here, confidence that helps you to be here. Some people, it's meaningful, the idea of inspiration. What inspires you? Are you inspired by the idea of being free? Are you inspired by people you know who have walked this path, who somehow have qualities which are meaningful for you to witness? Are you inspired by someone like the Buddha? Are you inspired by the teachings, which are quite amazing to kind of see these Buddhist teachings come together and how well they're organized and how well they speak to the human condition? What inspires you so that when you sit down, you're willing to give it your best, to be here and be still, to connect to A, to be at A, and then realize that A is your precious time, your time, to be conscious and present. And maybe if someone took a picture of you in 150 years, they'll look at you and say, that was her time. That was his time. Let's hope he, she used it well, was here for it each moment. So as you go about the retreat center here, it's very interesting. I've seen this especially at Spirit Rock because it's so big and so many people. The bell will ring at the end of the sitting, and it's really clear there are people who, as soon as the bell, I don't know what they were doing when they were sitting, but it's pretty clear that when the bell rings and they get up to walk out the door at Spirit Rock and out into the courtyard, it's clear from how they're not present anymore. They are somewhere else. They're like ahead of themselves or thinking about something and going on to the next thing and multitasking almost. And then there's people you watch and you see that it's not dramatically different, but you see, you watch them say, there's presence. They're there for opening the door. They're there for walking out into the courtyard. You feel that they're there. To have confidence, so what do you have confidence in those two different scenarios? And, usually we don't think about confidence in this way I'm emphasizing today. But the person who jumps up and rushes out and heads down the hill, Spirit Rock, for tea, without kind of really having any presence, has confidence in something. but it's probably not serving the person that well. And the person who you watch get up and has presence and is there has confidence perhaps in presence, in being present, being here. So what do you have confidence in? And can you give yourself over to here, to A, to being present? And the more you do it, the more your confidence will grow. And confidence with time becomes not just a capacity or a faculty, but it becomes a strength. And it becomes a strength that can carry you and support you in the ups and downs of life as we go through them. And you can actually feel it, almost like coursing through you, a sense of confidence and poise and presence that you carry with you as you go about. And the best thing I know to do is to acquire it by doing it, by engaging in it. So I think of confidence as kind of like the soil that a seed can grow. The seed of mindfulness, the seed of peace, the seed of presence, the seed of compassion and love. And so we have this soil that's there. We care and tend for the soil, and then the seed can grow. Or I think of it as confidence as a foundation, strong, stable foundation that allows us to stand or build something on top of that. That's going to be stable because it has a stable foundation. It's a beautiful quality. And it's there in your hearts as a potential. It's there as more than a potential. There's probably ways in which you already have confidence. And can you bring that forth a little bit more so it supports you here, engages you here, and support you in this beautiful process that you're involved in. As I come to a close, I just want to express my great appreciation for each of you and gratitude for doing this kind of practice. I don't think it's easy, and I think it's a really worthwhile and beautiful thing to do. And if some of you find that it's not easy and feel discouraged, maybe you don't have to be so discouraged if you realize it's not easy. And that's the nature of it sometimes. And so no need to be discouraged just means it's not easy. And then you kind of take the next step and take the next step and the next breath and keep going. One of the things that I've learned to trust, and here I like the word trust myself rather than confidence. I think one of the things I'm most grateful for this practice, is the trust I have that if I'm mindful, if I'm present and stay present in a mindful and good way, that life is trustable. That we can trust our life if we're really present and mindful for it. And that's one of the things we can discover as we enter into this world, take this journey into here, into A, is I'm hoping you'll learn that if you're clearly mindful, as your mindfulness is strong, no matter what happens to you, you'll be safe. It's a trustable place. There's deep, deep value in safety and freedom to be found. Each moment you're mindful. So, thank you for this. And it might be nice, since we're kind of here the first day and you're all kind of getting your bearings, if anyone has any questions you'd like to ask about the practice or your experience or being here, you're welcome to. We have a few minutes you could ask. Yes, please.
The question that you were talking experience of something being present in meditation. And as you were speaking, the word value came up. And it's like, maybe I thought, because many things have value, even the things that don't work very well. When we're not present, some things have value and have had value in the past.
Yeah, interesting. So I'm not sure I understand, but let me offer you this and see if it meets you. Is that I think what mindfulness, the approach of mindfulness, is to see everything as valuable. So even our delusion is valuable, even our fear is valuable. Not to be caught in it, but to meet it with respect, to see it, to be present. It's A. So rather than saying our fear is a bad thing that, you know, if we get caught up in our fear, it might take us away from A. But to turn towards fear and really see it, this is what's happening now, and see it with respect, or see it with as something valuable to pay attention to, but not something to forfeit our authority to. Not something to give into and get lost in, but something to care for and be present for. Because some of the most difficult aspects of ourselves might be things that actually need our care, need our attention. Is this speaking to you? Yes.
Could you say a few words about dealing with sleepiness as a...
Yeah, well, that's great. Sleepiness. So if you're really sleepy, you don't have a problem. Right, because you're just so you know just asleep. But if you're not so sleepy, but you're awake enough to know that you're sleepy, and you're kind of nodding or kind of like dragging. So there's two different primary approaches you can take. One is you can try to do something that wakes you up some. So you can open your eyes when you meditate. You can sit up straighter. The classic instruction is to sit in front of some place where you get light coming into your eyes. So maybe you're going to sit in front of the window there or something on a sunny day, and that's supposed to stimulate. What I like to do when I'm really sleepy is before going to meditate is I'll wash my face, my hands, my neck, and sometimes my feet with cold water. And that stimulates things a little bit so I'm not so sleepy. Or do faster walking meditation before coming in to sit and get the energy going. Or stand in the hall. So you can try to do something that works sometimes. The other, but in terms of your question of how to relate to it as A, in terms of mindfulness, you can turn towards the sleepiness and be very mindful of it, and start exploring what sleepiness feels like. Imagine you're supposed to be a connoisseur of sleepiness. You know, we're going to test you in a few days and you're going to tell us exactly what sleepiness feels like. So you feel, you know, it gets heavy around your eyes and your cheeks get kind of a little bit warm and dull, and the mind is kind of like dripping like mud, and you know it's like slogging through, and there's no energy in the spine or in the torso, and you just keep collapsing. You try to sit up, but there's no energy to hold you up, and so you go explore it and feel it and be present for it, and that does two things. Sometimes that interest and curiosity wakes you up. The other thing that it does is that it helps you to be present for what is, and you might start seeing more carefully what's here. One of the things you might see is that you have a lot of aversion, hostility towards being sleepy or to yourself to being sleepy. And by studying it, you see that. And then you can see, no, I don't know if I need to be hostile. Gil says, relax about being sleepy. Maybe I'll try it. And I can say that from a lot of experience, I had a lot of hostility to myself from being sleepy. And slowly I learned that not to do that. One of the things I learned about, one of the little tricks or, I don't know, secrets of meditation on retreat, is I learned that the practice unfolds the best, or unfolds well, from the continuity of our best effort. And so our best effort, though, is conditioned upon the kind of energy and different things happening any moment. And so it's not like best effort is always like 100% effort. You burn yourself out quickly then. But when you're sleepy, your best effort maybe is 10% effort. And that's the best that's available. And when you're awake and clear, maybe in the morning, maybe you have 60% effort, and that's the best that's available. Other times, maybe it's stronger. But the idea is the continuity of the best effort that's available, that's what carries you through time, not 100% effort all the time. Does that make some sense? So if you're sleepy, just do your best and be content. If you're doing your best with what little you have available, be content and keep doing it and keep applying yourself the best you can. Yes?
May I ask a question about the five faculties?
I suppose.
Okay. So if I understand what you've been saying, that these are the five faculties that support awakening.
Yes.
So my question is, why do you think the Buddha stopped at five? Why did he not include compassion as...
Why did the Buddha stop at five? Why not including compassion?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer, except my teacher in Burma, when we were meditating, he told us to put aside compassion while we were practicing. And not be concerned about it, because maybe it's a little bit extra. As the mind gets simpler and quieter, compassion requires an object of compassion, someone you're compassionate for. The mind has to be more active and busy thinking about it. And as the mind gets quieter and quieter, you don't want to think about anything so much, and other people and their suffering. And because the process of waking up or getting deeply concentrated has a lot to do, it's very much supported by the process of letting the mind getting simpler and simpler. And so you can the five faculties can operate there in the background. But compassion makes it a little bit more complicated what goes on. So it seems that in the time of the Buddha, compassion was seen as the result of awakening more than the process to awakening.
And it might arise naturally if you've got the five faculties.
So compassion will arrive naturally. It also seems like in the early suttas that compassion is compassion, loving kindness, the Brahmaviharas, seem to be presented more often than not as results of doing practice, rather than something you actively do on your own. So maybe one more.
You said you can't do confidence, but I have really noticed that your confidence in me somehow translates. That I call upon that. I call upon, like, Buddha, the Dharma, the people I sit with. There's some active engagement of trust that seems to cultivate confidence.
Great. So that's a little bit like being the inspiration, like what inspires you or other people's confidence. So we can call upon confidence. Maybe it's for semantics, but I don't think that we're doing confidence, but we're calling on it. So we're establishing it, or we're entering into it. But that sounds great. Isn't it great to be in a mutual confidence club? So I trust everyone kind of understands how things work here now well enough. I've been here for 24 hours. And now we have about 30, 35 minutes for a period of walking meditation, and then we'll have our supper.